Hello. Welcome back.
Where did I go?
I don't know. I presume you just weren't sitting in front of Skype for the past week since we hadn't talked.
Maybe I was, Dan.
That sounds sad.
Yeah. No, I wasn't.
So, what's new?
Not a mucho.
You always like to say that, don't you?
Yeah, well, it was the style at the time. I don't know. let's get them all out of the way.
Oh, dear.
And how. There we go. We're all set. We're done. We can call the podcast off now.
I did need a burrito tonight. I ate a quesadilla tonight, but it was burrito-esque.
I had tacos for lunch, but I had a burrito on Sunday because of our conversation about breakfast burritos on Saturday night. And I was like, you know what? Sunday morning, first thing on my docket, getting a breakfast burrito.
Our pseudo-private conversation via Slack about breakfast burritos that precisely three other people will know what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I wasn't specifically I just meant in general that you and I had that conversation, and I'm letting the audience know that. That was the extent of that conversation. Burritos.
Yeah, I think people have trouble imagining that we talk offline about the same sort of things, that it really is ingrained in our personality. It's not just the brand that we like to uphold on the podcast.
Speak for yourself. This is all acting. This is what this is right here.
Well, sir, you deserve a Emmy or Oscar or whatever it is they give to podcasters.
Yeah. Two of those, please, because it's so good, the acting that I'm doing right now.
I'll have what you're... wait, that doesn't work for awards, does it?
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Dear.
Oh, yes.
We'll get awards from iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Right after they figure out how to make rentals work properly.
Oh. See, this time it just buffered for like a minute for me. But then it kicked right in. Did you have the whole, the thing you rented didn't appear because you rented it on a different thing and then it wouldn't show up anywhere. And then it was like, maybe you do have it, maybe you don't have it. And you go to rent it again and it's like, no, you can't rent this because you already have it rented. And you're like, well, it's not here for me to watch. So I don't obviously have it rented, you jerks. Did you go through that song and dance?
More or less, basically. Mm-hmm. I rented it on my laptop, which of course didn't show up on the Apple TV despite
mistake
clicking
number
the
one.
Check for rentals. But, well, that's fine. And then what I do is, since I'm lazy and I don't want to get off the couch, I try and AirPlay it from my laptop in my office to the TV, which would work if the remote app ever worked, which it doesn't. So what I end up doing is I VNC into my laptop with screens, and then I try to AirPlay it from my laptop to the TV. But since screens is mirroring the display, I get an HTCP error because iTunes can tell that something is mirroring the display. So I have to just like jiggle it or something so that the remote app works, and then disconnect the VNC and then use the remote app to AirPlay over to the TV. But
Dan,
unfortunately, it worked relatively well, but I did have to get out of my seat once.
Dan,
yeah.
Can I just take a moment and say that was probably one of the stupidest things I've ever heard you say you did. That is
how else am I going to get it on the TV?
If you know you're going to watch,
I'm gonna
it
walk on, all the way across the house,
Dan. If you know you're going to watch it on the TV, why didn't you rent it on the TV?
I didn't know I was going to watch it on the TV. I was sitting in the office when I decided to rent it, and then I walked in the other room, and I'm like, oh, hey, you want to watch this movie with me? I rented it on the laptop in case you didn't, because you had other things to do.
Oh,
she's like,
no.
Oh, no. You know, come in and out of the room and watch a little bit here and there with you. I'm like, okay, I'll let me go get my AirPlay working.
You jinxed it by offering to share the movie experience with your significant other. Because
well, it's like I'm gonna go hide in the other room for 2.5 hours, so like I gotta at least, you know, introduce that conversation somehow.
Oh no, I completely understand. But this happened to me with Ghostbusters, because I was like, okay, so do you want to watch Ghostbusters with me? And Jason's like, yeah, okay, sure. He hasn't seen it, and I was like, okay, so let's watch it together. Unfortunately, I asked him after I rented it on my iPhone, and then I couldn't AirPlay it from my iPhone to his Apple TV, because it was trying to stream, because the way AirPlay works is that actually streaming to your phone over the Wi-Fi and then streaming from your phone to the Apple TV over the Wi-Fi. So apparently this causes just enough network traffic for it to stop every 30 seconds to a minute in buffer. So it was unwatchable. But I could watch it on my phone just fine, and it wouldn't show up on purchases on his Apple TV. And I happened to have my laptop with me, so I fire it up, and I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's in iTunes, and I can just download it. Also, no such luck there, because it didn't show up as a purchase. So, that was splendid. I just...
Couldn't you have downloaded it on the phone and then waited for that to finish and then AirPlayed it? Because I downloaded it to the laptop before I did anything here.
Oh, yeah, I wound up doing that with the Ghostbusters, but it still took a while for the whole movie to download.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's like, you know, 40 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least this one took 40 minutes because it's 2.5 hours long.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's why Apple TV is perfect, and Apple's Apple TV strategy for the past 3 years is just amazing, and there's nothing they could have done differently. Thank God they waited for whatever it is they're going to maybe not do for this fall. That there's nothing to improve. Just keep going.
Yeah.
Everything's fine.
Everything is fine. So I definitely shouldn't complain about more Apple technologies before we get into the movie, should I?
Well, is it going to be about how if you had your Apple Watch, you would have used that in your little rig machine of getting it on your TV?
No. I wanted to complain about other Apple technology. I've got two more items of follow-up, and I just realized they are complaining about other Apple items. We'll get one out of the way real quick. I have officially updated my Apple Pro Video Codecs for, I think, the 7th time in the past 2 weeks, which is delightful. I don't know why they keep sending me that. Thank you. Thank you for the applause.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is Apple Pay. I don't know. That was in the intervening time that we haven't been talking, right? Thanks to Apple Pay, I stole some sandwiches from, if you're curious, Firehouse Subs. I didn't go to Subway. But I stole some food, apparently.
Well, are you sure that actually happened that way? Did you go back to the store and check? Did you look at your... Did you look at your account to see if the transaction wound up going through?
I looked at my credit card statement. It is not there.
Oh. Well, so, you should rectify that. Captain America would be very upset.
So I'm going to drive all the way back over there with this receipt that I maybe do or don't have and then go like, hey, this thing that like totally cleared on your system and made a happy beep noise and printed out a receipt that said, you know, paid, didn't actually happen. So you should just charge me again and like not give me food.
Yes, you
like,
should.
Like, how am I supposed to have that conversation? Because everything on their end worked. Everything on my end worked. Everything on the little keypad thing worked. And then, like, I'm out of the store in my car driving home when the push notification shows up that says declined. And I don't understand what declined means in that context because my card is not declined. My card worked 5 seconds before at Walgreens across the street, also using Apple Pay. But apparently something through an error at some point, and way down the line, they didn't get their money, and I got my sandwiches. So maybe like they'll rectify it at the end of the month or something. Maybe there's some sort of thing that happens with Apple Pay that eventually that they will be able to get that money from me. But thus far, they have not received the $16 or whatever it was for the sandwiches and drinks that I took with me that day.
I don't like the moral ambiguity here. I am such a goody two shoes that I would march back to that store and rectify it. I would tell them to do it. And
well, this is what I'm saying. Like, how do I rectify it? What do I say?
You say
like,
this is my receipt.
Just charge me again.
Yeah, just charge.
I don't
me
know
again.
If I have the receipt. I don't usually keep receipts for.
Okay, well, tell
fast
them what
food.
Your order was. Don't you remember what you ate?
I don't know. There's 8 things on the menu.
Okay,
that
okay. So basically, you don't want to. That's fine. I understand. I'm just saying.
I don't know how to broach that conversation is what I'm saying. You know, if it was like something that I purchased that had like a tracking number on Amazon, I could say, hey, there was a problem here. Can you look at my order number? I don't think that their POS system has like an order number from last week sandwiches in it.
I think they keep that tracking stuff for a really long time if it's anything like a grocery store. But anyway, regardless... I'm saying that, you know, you also might want to get this fixed just for your, you know, well-being in the event that you go back to this Firehouse Subs and you go get more sandwiches. And then instead of it being all like happy-go-lucky when you're at the register. It's like, nope, screw this Dan guy. No sandwiches for Dan. So, you know, I don't like the mystery hanging out there, you know?
Well, I don't like it either, but the biggest mystery is why did it fail? Because I've used it there many times, and I used it literally 5 or 10 minutes before that same day, and it worked just fine.
I don't know. You're not going to find out by asking me. Should contact Apple or your credit card company.
We're asking the internet. Yeah, I'm going to call Bank of America to find out what happened.
Listeners.
They really seem on top of things.
Listeners, I want you to tell Dan everything that he's done wrong. Everything. Just go all the way back as far as you can. Tell him what you can do.
Thankfully,
to fix
it. They don't know most of the things I've done wrong.
Okay. All right. And so that concludes all the things you're angry about, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. We covered iTunes. We covered Apple in general for their ordering process, Apple Watch, and Apple Pay. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much everything I can complain
and
about.
And your codecs.
Yeah, and my codecs. I've been having relatively flaky Wi-Fi access with my AirPort Extreme, too. We can talk about that if you want.
No, Dan.
No?
But... I'm good.
Apple ecosystem?
I guess you could say your secret is you're always angry.
I always have a threshold level of anger towards my Apple products, so it makes the hard times slightly less bad when things go really bad. But I don't end up tearing like my shirt off when I get really angry.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's probably for the best. How's stuff at the gym?
How dare you? No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm sure the gym is just fine.
You're sure it's okay?
Yeah. I'm sure it's fine. It's still there. I mean, no like giant armor-plated snake-type things crashed into it and destroyed it.
It was more like a Tyrannosaurus eel. But
do those things have actual names?
Well, they have like little finny things, but anatomically it was a little unclear about how much of that is the armor and how much of that is like little fleshy bits underneath. Who knows?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Moray whale.
Yeah. Hmm. That's exciting.
I guess we could get right into it then, since we're already starting to talk about the movie.
Yeah, well, it's a long movie, so we should probably get started. Let's
not make this episode as long as the movie, please.
No, this is such a long movie. So, listeners, if you can't tell by, I don't know, all of the other clues, we're going to talk about Marvel's The Avengers. Not your fancy Ultron one. No, not that. Not the the brand spanking new Ultron-licious version. This is the good old-fashioned, like how they used to make Avengers movies back in the day, 2012 version of Marvel's Avengers. So we're going to go into that.
Marvel's The Avengers, not The Avengers, and not Marvel's Avengers Assemble. It is Marvel's The Avengers.
Remember the Avengers movie with Sean Connery in it?
I remember the one with Ray Fiennes.
Ray Fiennes?
Sean Connery's in it? Yeah.
Sean Connery was Augustus, what's his face? Anyway, that was not a good movie. Nobody go watch that. And we're not going to cover it on this podcast ever. But it has that title. So back to 2012, the future past of the Avengers of Sean Connery, or something.
He is in that, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I watched him in Zardoz this weekend too. So that was just have Sean Connery on the brain, I guess.
Is that the one where he wears like the leather diaper thing?
Yeah, the red diaper thing through the whole movie. I watched it for an upcoming Incomparable episode that I might not even be on, but I just wanted to be prepared. So I got that, you know, accomplished. I can cross that off my, I don't know, bucket list or something. It was one of those things. I was just sort of like, well, you know, everybody talks about how ridiculously bad it is, and all the, you know, stills from it look ridiculously bad. The premise sounds ridiculously bad. So this will be hilarious to watch. It was not hilarious to watch. It was actually really depressing,
emotionally scarring.
No, just tedious and dull and weird, and not in an entertaining way where you're just like, you know, laughing at how bad it is. This is just sort of... Anyway, I digress. Speaking of something that's not as bad as Zardoz, Marvel's The Avengers, directed by Joss Whedon. This is where you make your joke, Dan.
No, I've done it before. I'm not going to do it
again. Oh, you're not going to do it now? You're not going to do the funny joke now?
you already jumped the gun on my other terrible, well, leading commentary. So no, it's good. We'll just move past it.
Okay, we're gonna move right past it. Let's get right into the amazingness of this. The premise is that after the Iron Man movies, Iron Man's 1 and 2, and the Captain America, the first Avenger movie, so-called because they wanted to sell it outside the United States, go figure, and then the Thor movie, they're like, well, we're building to having our Avengers movie, and this is going to have a crap ton of people in it. And sure enough, it has a crap ton of people in it. And they're like, this is going to be complicated. Who could we get that could do all of these different dynamic people interacting in a comic book kind of a way? Oh, I know. Let's get the Buffy guy. So they have Joss Whedon direct this magnificent piece of film. It is one of those things where when I first saw this, I was actually pretty enthusiastic about it. Enough so that I recommended to Jason that we go see it again, because he had also wanted to go see it. And so we watched it, and he hated it. And I found that I also did not like the second time I watched it. And it wasn't just because he hated it, because we didn't talk about how he hated it until after we got out of the movie theater. But it's like, you know, it's not as good as the first time I saw it, because I'm thinking more about what's happening in these scenes, and it's not... it doesn't make a lot of sense. And the motivations just aren't quite there. The character stuff, the sparks that fly between these characters as they talk and have their witty little banter, like, that's fine. That is good stuff. And I think that the emotional component of that can often distract from the giant gaping plot holes, where you could fall horribly down to the face of the earth from your flying aircraft carrier. That was one of those things about this kind of thing. It's just like, I can't think of how I could better make this film because of the number of things that have to be checked off on a checklist in order to make this. And I think that a lot of the praise that the film gets is because he manages to check off all those boxes on the checklist. And I don't know if that in and of itself is necessarily worthy of calling it a good film, but still, it's not a bad film. And it's not really, it's better than mediocre, but it's just sort of not as amazing as a lot of people would espouse to you. Would you agree with that assessment, Dan? What are your personal feelings on this? Search your feelings, Dan. You know it to be true.
I have a lot of similar feelings. I would probably describe them a little differently, but even only 3 years ago, it's so hard to remember the context of this movie for me because, you know, I'm looking at it and like, okay, sure, I can remember it in the lineage of which other Marvel films had come out at the time and what we're building on top of and what has yet to come. But like the biggest reminder was, you know, Iron Man is gearing up his Mark 7 suit. And I'm like, oh, they got a long ways to go before we get to Iron Man 3 and his Mark 42 suit. But anyway, but like, you know, all of the bringing the characters together, that's a monumental task that, you know, is difficult for pretty much anyone. There's really no right way to do it, and you're almost certainly going to piss off a lot of people. But, when watching this now, I always have this weird feeling when I think back to the movie. When I'm watching it, yeah, sure, it feels pretty good, but... as soon as I leave it, I feel like, yeah, that was a good movie. All of the characters that I know and I enjoy were there and they were doing stuff and they were punching things and this and that. But you forget just how much groundwork has to be laid in the first, you can't even say first half of this movie, the first 2 hours of this movie before the last 30 minutes of this movie. Because when I think of the Avengers, I think of the... I mean, sure, there's funny bits here and there throughout the whole thing, but I generally think of the Avengers movie being that battle at the end there, which is literally 30, 40 minutes out of this 2.5-hour movie. And all of that other stuff, it doesn't really hold up. It feels like it prematurely aged itself. Like watching it now, it's like it feels like these characters have grown 15 years in the past 3 years. And I found it hard to believe that this movie came out in 2012 because it felt, you know, at least 2 or 3 years older than that, just in terms of the timeline of all these things. And maybe that's just because we've been utterly saturated with Marvel material. But there's a lot of – how do I put this delicately? I am not the world's biggest Joss Whedon fan. I think I've said some things to that tune before. But
yeah, I found some of the things – I think you're thinking of Will Wheaton.
Yes, exactly.
See, I did it. I did it because you weren't going to do it. That's what I'm doing for our listeners, to sacrifice.
I appreciate
that I
you inserting the humor at this point. Mm-hmm. I was leaving you open to it. That's what she said. Anyway,
I
enjoy some of the things he brought to a Marvel movie. You know, he's kind of known for his witty banter here and there, and some of that stuff is good. And a lot of it rubs me the wrong way, though, because some of it just seems really inappropriate. Like when it lands where you've got this action mixed with the human personalities who occasionally crack jokes and they talk like human beings. But when it doesn't land, it just feels so out of left field that it just annoys the crap out of me. And then there are other things about this movie that I look at, and maybe it's me being familiar with the visual effects industry and just the filmmaking that went into this, because everyone has seen all of the behind-the-scenes stuff. You've seen the green screen sets. You've seen all of this stuff. But I can see the pieces now when I watch back, and I go, okay, basically everything in the main battle at the end takes place in this one strip of road, because what are they going to do? They're not going to have 30 different practical sets all around, you know, New York that are going to look like this. But part of it, it doesn't feel like this is going to sound wrong, but the scale feels slightly smaller than a $220 million movie to me. And I know the visual effects of it are rampant, and that's clearly where the budget is. But like the filmmakingness of it, like the sets and where things happen and the scenes and the major set pieces, there aren't as many as I remembered in my head, I guess is the way to say it.
Okay. Because I'm going to say that specifically of that end battle that you're referring to, I do know what you mean, where you're saying this street that they're on, where they filmed all these characters with all the wrecked cars and stuff, and they run around and they say their things. They make it feel a lot bigger by the extension that they do with all of the CG New York that goes around on either side of the street and up into the sky. And I think that goes a long way in making it not feel like they are in a small, tiny little space. But if you had done this, I don't know, 10 years earlier, you would be talking about like some stretch of road in Cleveland or something they would have closed off and then like faked a couple like matte painting shots or something. Like that what they did here, I think it feels far more integrated and makes it feel much more like New York. And they try to mitigate that a lot by having all of those flying little chariot scenes where they're going through all of the other side streets around that perimeter area, around that 3-block radius they're trying to maintain. So I think it feels sufficiently large for what it is. In a way, also, where I wonder, you know, like the giant hole left by this battle would have been a little much, but the area to me feels of sufficient size. The things that feel weird, I think, are some of the other things where it's all extension. And by that I mean, like, when they're in the lab, every time they have a scene in that lab on the helicarrier, you're looking out that back window of the lab, which just shows that big empty bay that's there with people walking on catwalks nonstop. And that's to make it feel like it's this big helicarrier. That's why you're looking out that window all of the time, which doesn't make any sense. But that doesn't work for me because I'm distracted by the like forced sense of scale in something like that compared to like the street stuff at the end. Does that make sense as a criticism?
Yeah, I think what we're feeling is the same thing, and maybe it's just because I spent more time looking at that street stuff in the behind the scenes. And, you know, when this came out, it does suggest a larger scale than is physically possible to shoot in any situation. And I think they do a good job of that stuff in the actual end battle stuff. But there are elements of the plot that even sort of feel like they're trying to contain the amount of work. Like, you know, the direction Captain America gives to, you know, try and contain everything to this 3-block area as best we can, and, you know, try and drive everyone back to the center here so they battle against us. And like, those feel like plot elements that are trying to maintain to contain the budget of the project. And maybe that's just my personal bias. And because I know, you know, like, there are shots that you saw that were recorded from people's cell phones when they were recording this, like with the cars exploding and the cops running away. And I remember seeing that when it was on. I probably just followed too many blogs at the time when the movie was coming out. And then I saw, you know, the bus and everything, that whole set on the green screen. You saw that left and right in the behind the scenes stuff. But the helicarrier is its own thing there, with implying a larger space that doesn't necessarily get explored. But I think some of it is just the confusion of the layout. Like, we don't necessarily go to these places that we see all the time. And in that end battle, it is kind of, sure, it's a battle, so it's going to be disjointed and all over the place, but you don't really get a sense of where things are. You just get this sort of chaos that, okay, we're on a street now that looks different from another street, so it feels bigger, but I have no idea where we actually are. Well, and I'm not saying you actually need that, but no, that's what the feeling is.
No, I disagree, because they heavily rely on landmarks. We're constantly looking at parts of Grand Central Terminal and parts surrounding it. Like, I recognize that little tunnel thing they fly through that's right by Grand Central and the buildings across from it and stuff like that. I do feel a sense of the geography. However, I will say, I will completely admit that I can recognize that because I've seen those places in person. I don't know how someone would feel if they hadn't walked around that area of Grand Central. If this is the first time you've ever seen that part of New York, then you would have no idea at all what's going on in this specific spot. Or if you saw it at night or something, it looks totally different. But the you know, they even crashed one of those whale eels into the the side of the terminal there. So it's I feel like that has sufficient geography. There's other stuff, of course, where they're just like breaking generic buildings, and we see generic office building number 47, that kind of thing. That means nothing to me, but I'm kind of used to that from, I don't know, Spider-Man movies, which just seem to have a generic assortment of New York-ish feeling buildings. That sort of thing, since I don't need to rely on the geography because the characters aren't doing anything that relies on geography, then that seems to make a little sense whenever we cut away to those things. I do like having the other things, though, that anchor it with those landmarks of Grand Central. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And the repetition, because I recognize the outside of that Grand Central building there, but we see it many times, which kind of, again, reinforces to me that this is that main street where everything is going to happen. And I guess maybe I just feel like maybe it's a story thing. Like, why did these the whale eels not just come out of the portal and, like, all three or four of them immediately go to opposite sides of the planet? Because they decided to just focus immediately right here. Like, why didn't they spread out more quickly? Maybe that's what I'm worried about, and like why it kind of bothers me that it's all contained to this one area.
Okay, well, that's a completely separate problem. If we're going to talk about the battle tactics,
it's related, but sure.
Well, I know, but the battle tactics of this film make no sense. We're going to kind of work backwards to front, I guess. But none of the things that they do are what you should do if you were invading anything. They open this portal. They send through a bunch of little tiny dinky people, and they spread out, mostly get shot up, and they fire little things all over the place. And then one of the whale eels comes through, and people shoot off of that onto the buildings. And that's a very big, dramatic scene that happens, because this is this huge thing. And if you're paying attention early in the film, you saw one kind of swimming by in the background, but you didn't really see much of it. And so this is going to be a big, horrible monster they have to take care of. They did a similar thing in Thor where they had like a bulldog looking beast thing. But it was just sort of like a big dumb monster obstacle that you have to get through. They have this thing there. They finally work together to defeat it. And then Loki's like, oh yeah, send in all the rest. And then they all just sort of like, whoop, right up the portal. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, if you had all of those, why didn't they go through the portal earlier? And if you had all of these people, why did you send through just like a couple at a time? And if you have a giant interstellar army, why didn't you just dispatch really fast moving ships and a big arsenal of weapons to just fire everything on the planet's surface, decimate it, and then you would deal with whatever rubble is left? I don't understand the goal here. Even the little foot soldier guys are like, we're going to round up all of these people in an office building and then maybe throw a grenade at them.
Maybe they were just trying to kill as many people as possible and they figured they would corral them first, but yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. If their goal is to kill people instead of subjugate people, then they would just drop whatever their equivalent of a nuclear device is through there. And we know that this movie is aware of nuclear devices because they also throw that into the plot because we needed something else to raise the stakes. So the battle strategy of these aliens, horrible. Battle strategy of Loki, also horrible. Oh, my brother hit me off this building. I'm just going to go fly around on this floating chariot for a while and just shoot random stuff and you won't see me for 5 minutes.
Well, an argument can be made that Loki is just sort of rolling with the punches because he says the situation kind of got out of his control. So it's like, well, there's no stopping it now, so we're just going to see this thing through to its conclusion. But yeah, the strategy does not make a ton of sense. And the nuclear add-on there at the end kind of feels like they were just pulling a ripcord on the plot. Like, well, what do we do now? It's like, I know how we get out of this. The council, whoever the hell they are, decide that this has just gone too far and we're just going to blow everything up, but then we'll use that. And then, you know, spoiler, once they go through the portal with the nuke, you see they have even more troops that they hadn't yet sent. So, sure, maybe they felt the need to send them in waves for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, and they had like a giant, I don't know, space station, spaceship? I'm not clear on what that was.
That was like the Independence Day sort of mothership that's controlling everyone because...
Oh, yeah.
Again, jumping to the end, spoiler, blowing up the mothership causes all of the people on Earth to die. Bad guys, I should say.
You have no idea how much I rolled my eyes. Even the first time I saw this movie when I liked it, I was just like, oh, my God. This cliche is probably one of the all-time worst cliches in sci-fi films that I can think of. And in children's entertainment. And sure, this sort of like borders both and somehow manages to do it. It's just like... I really would expect better from basically anyone than to put this in the plot. Disabling something and then like all of your minions lose their power and die or fall over. Like, did we not learn our lesson? Have we not learned our lesson about why this is stupid and why no one really buys that as a practical thing? I can't wait for Marvel's Age of Ultron, Avengers 2. That comes out this Friday, when I'm sure that they'll defeat Ultron, and then all of the little Ultron bots and his software and like whatever devices will probably fail. And this isn't a spoiler because I haven't seen the movie. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, maybe they'll fire up some sort of EMP that will destroy them all.
Yeah, because I mean that's what you need. You need a ton of things that are cannon fodder, and then. You just have like a, okay, well, we've showed sufficient people being beaten up now. Let's just turn it off. And that's what it is. It's just, it does that thing. It's what it does. I hate it. It's stupid.
And then it is a weird thing to be in this movie. It again feels like an afterthought because a lot of thought went into the characters. You know, this is probably one of the first, one of the bigger examples of the Marvel movies where you see the characters actually getting tired and they're kind of being worn down by this giant threat. And for all of my complaints about the scale and the method of attack from the bad guys, they do sort of wear the Avengers down and sort of get the better of them from time to time. You know, there is a little bit of like, they're kind of getting their butts kicked here for a moment. And then the score turns sad and you kind of feel like, oh no, maybe they're not going to pull through and just pound everyone into the ground. It's like, no, I mean, they will, obviously, because it's the movie's called The Avengers and they're going to win. But, you know, there was actually some humanity, not just in their quippy little lines and personality. There was some humanity put into the fact that, like, yeah, this would probably exhaust both physically and mentally a lot of these people. And we actually saw that in the movie, which was impressive.
Except for Except for Clinton Barton. I take issue with this. I think they feel like they did him enough of a disservice earlier in the film that in the end battle, they basically have him get a little winded and run out of arrows. nothing really bad happens to him. And it's just like, this is your archer who is going up against an intergalactic army, and you have your demigod villain, and he gets a little winded and runs out of arrows. That is what he has going on. And
he's unflappable.
Yes. Yes. I don't like Hawkeye. Not to go off on a tangent from our tangent, but I really don't like Hawkeye. Even when he's a good guy Hawkeye, I don't like Hawkeye. The only time I've ever liked Hawkeye was in Matt Fraction's run on Hawkeye, the comic book, which I'm sure you've heard many podcasters reference, because apparently the Avengers are saving Beverly Hills or something. But no doubt you've heard the Matt Fraction Hawkeye, and it's unfortunately come to an end of its run. But it's you know, that was good, because it was just like him as an everyday guy, and how he deals with all of the crazy shenanigans that he has to deal with in his life. And when I see him in a movie like this, him and with ScarJo as a Black Widow, it's just like you guys are so horribly outmatched for the situation that you are in this film that it just doesn't even seem fair to put you in here. Black Widow acquits herself much better, I think, in the Captain America 2 movie. I think that works out far better than this, and is much more convincing. She is a spy doing spy stuff, and that is what she excels at. There isn't even a line in this film where it's just like, yes, she is a spy, but she is a soldier because she had to save Clint. That was just like, okay, well, he's saved now. You can stop jumping over cars and shooting people with tiny, tiny little guns. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, there are some, they don't give much personality to Hawkeye, especially in comparison to the rest of the characters in this movie. They give him a fair amount of silly dialogue like they give everyone, but we don't really get to know Hawkeye in any sense in this movie. And maybe that part of that is because he's sleep deprived and has blue irises for most of this movie. But
the evil eyes.
Sure, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. He just looks tired and he has contacts in. But there are a couple moments that just feel inconsistent in that stuff. And maybe this is me projecting onto Joss. I don't know if it's his fault or not. But, like, you know, I loved when Black Widow did her little, like, fake hurt thing to get the information out of Loki, even though that information seemed ridiculous. I like how she sort of played him and got the information. But, you know, then there was a moment after, and I admittedly, being chased around the inside of a helicarrier by the Hulk would probably be relatively frightening for anyone. But there's that moment where, like, they cut back to her and she's like huddling in the fetal position, like almost crying, and she's just like trying to hide from everything. But it finally snaps her back to reality because they've got to go. You know, Hawkeye is attacking the place, and she needs to go get him. But like, I'm like, why is she just huddling in the corner crying? Like, presumably she got away from the Hulk and she's hiding. But like, she looks like she's had her entire spirit broken, and that seems completely at odds with the character that we know up until now. And there, you know, there's these weird moments that just feel super inconsistent. And of course, Hawkeye in general feels inconsistent because we just don't know anything about him.
Yeah, I think that they are the two weakest characters of the film, which is unfortunate. But they get moments, but they don't get like structure to back up those moments. I find the helicarrier attack especially problematic. Once we're finished with our end of the movie, we can move backwards to that. But the Any other criticisms for the end of the film?
God. See, I don't think we can even go through this in order. We should just pick pieces here and there and just see where that leads us.
Okay.
Because, you know, just the other overarching thing is, I mean, Robert Downey is Iron Man. He's Tony Stark. He's got that character down pat. But in this movie, he feels different, and a lot of it I don't like. It's just another one of those things where I think the writing is weird for him. And, like his, it seems like they intentionally chose like random wardrobe for him. That's like, this looks different than the other movies, but it just looked dumb and odd at times. Like it felt like, Tony Stark's like twin brother who missed the other movies.
I think he's very consistent. But I mean, I can see the wardrobe thing cause they're kind of like Affliction t-shirts, but the,
and that really ridiculous, like half suit looking jacket that he wears on the helicarrier. I don't know why that outfit just bothers the crap out of me.
Okay.
It looks like it has a strip of like LED lights that goes around the collar.
It doesn't though, but, I'm sorry, Dan.
It has a shiny line of plastic that goes around the collar.
Yeah, well, I mean, they gave him lots of great lines, though. Like, make your move, reindeer games. And doth mother know you weareth her drapes? Like, you know, Shakespeare in the Park. This is all, it's all good stuff. Like,
He has a lot of good stuff, but there's also some other ones that are just like, you don't have to pretend to be Tony Stark. You are Tony Stark, so just, like, let it chill. And then, you know, one of the other lines that was in the trailer, they used a different take in the trailer, is the... big man in a suit, take that away. What are you? What does he say? Billionaire, playboy, philanthropist, something or other.
Yeah.
And he has like a jokey kind of off the cuff response in the trailer. And he has a very serious, like, I know who I am response in the movie. And I hate the version that's in the movie. I like the trailer version a lot better.
Okay. It's a criticism I've never thought about before. But
it's his line delivery. It's his personality. Okay. They're screwing with his personality in this one a little bit, and I don't like it.
Okay. Well, I have to say the biggest example of screwing with his personality is that in an effort to make Captain America the brains of the Avengers, they in terms of strategy and planning and teamwork, they undermine Tony to a great degree. And we know that he doesn't play well with others, and we know that he's a loner and doesn't want to go along with the team and thinks he's better than everybody else. But there are some really stupid things he does in this film. Chief among them, when Thor mysteriously attacks that Quinjet, and then he takes off with Loki, and then Captain America says, Stark, we need to have a plan of attack. And Stark's reply is, I have a plan. Attack. And the fact that that was written that way is kind of troublesome. They kind of undermine his intelligence in ways that I don't feel like if this was an Iron Man movie, I don't think he would necessarily think or say or do these things. I think it's because Steve Rogers has to be the leader that he kind of comes off sort of stupid and like the one who's not going along with the team stuff and the one who's not gathering up the forces to do what needs to be done. Like that falls much more heavily, I think, on Steve Rogers, Captain America.
Yeah, because they do gloss over that particular moment by saying, if we lose Loki, we'll never find the cube. But you weren't using Loki to find the cube in the first place. You were using your gamma scanner doodad, so... who cares? And then I at least liked the Tony Starkish line where he says, don't touch my stuff, when he's talking to Thor. But you're right. That whole let him go, who cares where Loki goes, as long as you guys get the cube back. But I guess if they didn't really know that Thor was on their side, even though Tony Stark appears to be fully aware of who Thor is and the fact that he's kind of on the shield side, that he shouldn't have been quite so concerned about that.
Well, this is one of those things. As we've referenced in a previous show, in our concerns about Batman versus Superman, Dusk of Justice, the whole thing here is that in comic books, we have our heroes fight each other, 'cause nerds want to know how such and such hero would do in a fight between such and such a hero. They want to know who's the most powerful or who has a tactical advantage or who's the smartest or whatever. It's all stupid, but it happens. It is a thing. And because it happens, we have the scene where they beat each other up in some forest in Germany, which is not really a forest in Germany. Spoiler alert. It's totally not.
It's totally not a forest anywhere at all.
Are you
it's not
implying,
even outside, as far as I'm aware.
Are you implying that there might be something in this film that's not really shot photographically with lens and film, celluloid film? No.
The stuff that you can tell is photographic is the stuff that has lighting that doesn't match the background. But we'll get to that a little later. But
zing.
The battle in the forest is actually pretty spectacular. But I did get a little fatigued because, of course, I try and take notes. I don't necessarily reference them when we do these podcasts. But I found myself at one particular point in the movie, like every line I wrote was blank first blank. Next line, blank first blank. And it's like, okay, Hulk fights Thor. And then we've got Black Widow hiding. Thor gets tricked by Loki. Black Widow fights Hawkeye. We've got Coulson versus Loki. We've got every single potential permutation of characters fighting characters in this movie, which is fine because there's personality conflicts and they're going to argue and that sort of stuff is just bound to happen with these kinds of things. But they're literally fighting each other full-on battles in every single combination you can imagine because it's cool, even though we eventually know that they're going to have to get over their differences and work together. So,
yeah,
sure, they're giving us that that fan service of every last little bit of it. Everyone's going to show their powers, and they're going to see who would win in what situation. And of course, it's a stalemate in almost every situation, which makes no sense.
Well, that's because they want to show that they all have their advantages. So that's why Thor stupidly hits the vibranium shield, and being the only spot that Thor should not hit, and the whole thing with Iron Man where he's going toe to toe with him and then shoots him with lightning and somehow charges his battery.
Sure,
and yeah, that's how batteries work.
Apparently, arc reactors don't overload.
Yeah, I mean.
The first Iron Man movie where you can manually overload it and then kill the bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, you just keep shooting energy into something, just raw lightning, that converts into arc reactor energy. And 400%, that's good, right? Like, you got batteries for that, right? 400% of your normal charge? Anyway, it's pretty patently ridiculous. The fight, I think, also goes on too long. It doesn't make any sense to begin with. And is sort of pointless. The only nice thing is that you get a little snarking from Loki about the battle, and you get a little and some reaction shots from him, and you get some snarking from Stark about the battle against Thor. But that's it. And then at the end of it, they're just like, "Oh well, I guess we fought. We're done. Let's just get back on the Quinjet or whatever and go to the helicarrier."
The only leap I can make at that point in my mind is like Thor at times states how he's sort of trying to protect the Earth, and Loki pokes fun at him saying you do a terrible job of that because they're all killing each other. And I guess when he sees that his little battle here just cleared an entire forest with that blast and he's actually destroying a bunch of stuff that he's theoretically supposed to be protecting, that he's like, oh, maybe I'm the jerk and I should stop like hitting everyone.
Yeah, well, Thor's an idiot.
Adopted. Oh wait, no, that's the other one.
Yeah. But anywho, this is by far one of those ridiculous things where it's just like I kind of could have done without this. I know that some people will disagree because they like some of the funny little moments in here, but I don't think it really contributed much. And given the runtime of this film, I could have done without it. The other time where they go head to head with each other, where they're butting heads and not working as a team, is on the helicarrier, of course, when everything falls to pieces. And we get, you know, Hulk versus Black Widow, Hulk versus Thor. We get Hulk versus I don't know if that was a Harrier or what that was, but that happened.
It was a non-existent blade.
Yeah. And then the Hawkeye versus Fury, you know, with whatever that computer terminal PS2 port arrow is. And then the... It's just... Of course, you have one of those arrows. That makes total sense.
There's a universal interface on the helicarrier that you can access.
Yeah, I think that's USB-C by plugging C-DAN. Into. It's USB-C.
Yeah, you plug in one thing, and then you've got control over all of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And in that same sequence, I think the scene that I find the most confusing in the movie is the one right before that, where all of them are in the lab, like, arguing at each other.
Oh, yeah, and then they're not together. Yeah, like, the explosion happens, and then 5 seconds, they're not together at all.
Well, they, like, run out the room. But the thing that weirds me out about the whole thing is that I can't tell, based on the way it's shot, I don't know if it's done with the express purpose of saying that Loki is still sort of using the scepter that's in the room to kind of, like, amp up their general anger towards each other, or they're generally are they honestly being this petty and arguing with each other? Because there are some weird shots that I don't know if they're just done for cinematic editing purposes, but, you know, they're all yelling and they're all being super petty and they're all getting on everyone's nerves and they look like they're about to fight, and then the camera does that weird, like, 360 roll thing where it's focused on the scepter, which they use to sort of cut to Loki. But it's like, are they being manipulated right now into like getting under each other's skin, or are they just generally not happy to be in the same room as each other?
No, this is all part of his plan, and they are being manipulated. I think the filmmaking, to my eyes, is pretty consistent on that, with the weird shots, like you're saying, implying that the scepter is exerting some sort of control. They focus on the scepter while they're arguing. Not that there are, like, laser beams shooting out of it or anything saying, like, hey, I'm controlling you. But this the way, like, that one specific shot that you mentioned definitely implies that to me, as well as some of the sillier things they say to one another, because it's almost like drunk people arguing. They are not saying completely logical, well thought out criticisms of one another at a certain point. Thor especially seems sort of befuddled by what he's saying. And there are a couple of, like, Dutch shots in there too.
Where they're almost laughing like they actually look drunk, and that is a great comparison about drunk people arguing. But it while that seems like an interesting idea, and it seems like maybe that was Loki's plan all along. It just sort of, that whole idea just disappears after they sort of just quickly snap out of it when Hulk's holding the scepter and they're like, dude, put that down or I'm going to shoot you. And you're like, whoa, how did it escalate to this? But it just, the whole idea just evaporates. And I didn't buy that at all. It just seemed like an idea that was interesting for a scene to increase the tension, to distract us from what was about to happen. But it felt wrong.
I mean,
I'm still not entirely convinced that they were actually being manipulated by the scepter.
Okay.
I didn't see enough justification of that.
I feel differently, but I don't know. I feel differently. I feel like it is, from my perspective watching it, that it's pretty clear that it's exerting control over them in terms of what they've selected here for showing it. They don't ever explicitly say it, though. And I think that all of the implicit stuff maybe could be interpreted as wishy-washy, but I choose to believe that it is exerting control. The thing here is also that the scepter is acting as a homing beacon, because when Hulk touches the scepter, we get that shot of... Well, I don't think it was exactly right when he touched it or when he put it down, but we got the shot of the Quinjet that is approaching that Hawkeye confiscated, where they can see that display readout of the scepter on their... I don't know why they have that clip art, but they do.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I thought, like, that scene was building toward. So inevitably the scene is going to end with that scepter, and we see that Hawkeye is coming in and he sees where the scepter is. But everything up until that point didn't really seem to jive with it. So the scepter is like a blaster. It's also for giving people blue eyeballs and making them follow you around. It's also apparently a remote control for mind wiping people or making them act like drunk idiots. And it's also like a GPS tracking device. Like, I don't. Is it just because it's magical that it can do whatever it feels like in any particular scene? I don't particularly like that, but
It would have been nice if they defined a couple things that it could not do, rather than it conveniently doing lots of things. It is pretty convenient that it happens to just keep adding features as we go through the film. But it's not to say that it can't do those things. It's just that since we don't know the full extent of the rules of it, that it can feel a little confusing if you try to figure out, reverse engineer how this is a thing, how this this works as a device. But you know, maybe we'll get some of that since we see the scepter in the trailer for Avengers 2 Age of Mangoes.
Is the scepter in the trailer for Avengers 2?
Yeah, and it was in, I thought I saw it in one of the trailers. I can't remember which one of them. They've released so many trailers, it's in the end of Captain America 2 Winter Soldier, I mentioned on a previous podcast. This is not a spoiler alert at this point. I really hope not. But there are these things at the end of these films where they set up future movies. I don't know if you guys have maybe heard of them, or if you just elected to walk immediately out of the theaters whenever the credits show up, but listeners, I encourage you to maybe check these things out. You can also usually find them on YouTube because people love to do that. But the end of that movie, they show that the scepter has fallen into some nefarious hands, and that they are using that to do stuff still. It seems to have even more features, so you can complain about that, I'm sure, for the next one. But the...
You know how long it's been since... I saw this, and maybe it's because of Guardians of the Galaxy. I legitimately forgot Thanos' name by the time I finally saw him at the end of the movie.
Oh, well, his name's Thanos.
Yeah.
By the way.
He's going to be our bad guy from now until the end of, what is that, 2020, when they get to the end of this whole thing?
You know, there's this, not to sidetrack us from our sidetracks of our sidetracks, but I'm skeptical that everything's going to go off without a hitch to maintain the slate of films. If anyone can do it, it will be Disney. But I don't know if it's feasible for this level of planning to go smoothly. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But. It's a long time. It's a long ways away. This is a big setup for this. But anyway, this silly scepter. There are also some other things that don't make a lot of sense. With the scepter, when Loki is inside of his jail cell, opens the cell and steps out, and Thor rushes him, but it was an illusion, and then he's on the other side, and then the door is closed, and he teleports. Loki's teleportation in this movie is inconsistent, because sometimes he does it and it works out to his advantage, and then other times he stands right where he is and gets the crap beaten out of him. And it doesn't seem related to whether or not he has the scepter. That doesn't seem to be a power of the scepter. He can teleport and pull off illusions all by himself, and he does so in the other Thor films. So I don't know why that only happens periodically, where he's able to take advantage of this property, but he does do it on occasion, and one of those occasions is when he is released from that cell through this trickery, and then jettisons Thor, and then Agent Coulson walks in with the rifle that's engineered after the destroyer from the first Thor movie, which is some deep catalog stuff at this point. And then just think about that. This is a weapon in this movie that references a movie outside of it for a villain that wasn't really even a villain, who we only kind of sort of saw. So That exists. And so Agent Coulson fires it, and before he fires it, Loki teleports behind him and stabs him with the scepter, but he didn't have the scepter in the previous scenes. He had just gotten out of the cell. So he somehow got the scepter from the lab and then went back and stabbed him in, like, less than a second. Because he...
See, I never read it as teleportation, which I guess would explain it better, especially in this particular instance. I always viewed it as his ability to project himself. So, like, he was already out of the cylinder, knew Thor was going to come through at some point. So he put his projection just hanging out in there while he was running around going to get the scepter. But then his projection would also have to have the ability to push buttons, because then it's doing the control panel when Coulson rolls up. So Loki would have had to know the entire time that he was at risk of somebody rolling up with a gun to shoot him. So he's going to maintain the projection there the whole time so he can sneak up behind and stab him. Because if it was actual teleportation, yeah, that would make sense. But, like, can his projection actually push the buttons? Or there's another inconsistency, I suppose.
Yeah. Either he teleported or it was a projection, like you're saying. But if it was
that
projection...
That can push buttons.
Yeah. Well, it pushes your buttons.
There's so many... And are we... I don't feel like we're nitpicking a fantasy world of magical things that aren't real in the first place. I feel like we're asking actual questions about consistency within this world, that there are just so many unanswered or just inconsistent answers that I think it just over the course of this movie builds up to this sort of odd feeling that we have, that in spite of this movie being all of the fun characters that we enjoy smashing into each other in maybe nonsensical but kind of satisfying battles, like, there's this sort of overarching feeling of just general chaos and inconsistency that kind of makes it a weird movie. And maybe that's just because they had to get from point A to point B in the Avengers Marvel universe, and this is just the kind of stuff they had to do. But it feels like a lot of those character moments didn't necessarily have to be so contradictory.
Well, I think the things that I find contradictory aren't really the character moments. It's the logic of these mechanics.
Well, right. It's the things the characters are deciding to do in given places. Like, there is a lot of – I do want to give credit to the writing in that. There is a lot of economy of writing. Even for a 2.5-hour movie, we find out a ton of stuff that wouldn't necessarily have been in this movie if a different writer were in this place. Like, even in that moment where Black Widow is, like, tricking Loki into giving up some information, which seems weird, we find out a fair amount about her backstory and Hawkeye's backstory that was, you know, relatively, I mean, economical isn't the most flattering term to use, but there are a lot of scenes where we learn about one thing as we're building towards something else, and we actually get a lot out of the scene, but the pieces just don't really seem to fit together with the rest of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, but that goes back to, I think, something I said earlier, where the, you know, he gets a lot of praise for the difficulty of checking all these checkboxes, of putting all of these things in this film, and, like you're saying, the economy of being able to do it. I mean, even though this is an incredibly long movie, it has so many things in it. It is so jam packed of with the stuffs that what is there could easily have been stretched out into several movies. That this is, you know, it's got a lot going on. Even though we've already had movies for Iron Man, we still have lots of Iron Man set up at the beginning of this. Even though we've had movies for Thor, we have scenes between Thor and Loki where they go back and forth about setting up things that happened in the previous movies. It's almost as if it's trying to set up stuff so that if you hadn't seen any of the other Marvel films, then you would have been fine. Although I don't think you would have been fine.
What? People would show up and see this movie without watching all of the other 6-7 preceding movies?
Well, no, for this, there's only three preceding movies. I'm sorry, four preceding movies that you would have had need to have known: Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Thor, and Captain America: The First Avenger.
Well, let's be real. Is anything from Iron Man 2 actually in this movie?
ScarJo, Nick Fury.
I guess technically,
yeah.
Wasn't Nick Fury at the end of the first Iron Man?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, but he was in the second one too, and Scarlett Johansson. Was in the second one, the sort of that thing planted the seed for everything that came after it. And Captain America was the Tesseract, and Thor was that doctor guy I can't remember the name of, and Agent Phil Coulson and Hawkeye were set up in that. But I mean, Hawkeye wasn't really set up in that. He's just sort of in the shadows, and I didn't even know who it was really, I think, the first time I saw it. So yeah, there's that.
Fair enough.
But anyway, yeah, so he gets a lot of credit for the amount of stuff he crams in here and recaps.
Yeah, and it certainly is a monumental task, and this is sort of what I'm getting at with trying to remember the perspective at the time, because it was impressive that he was able to tie these things together, and it was the sort of the beginning of the glimmer that, like, okay, maybe this whole Marvel universe of movies till 2045 or until we all die is actually something that could potentially work. And we were all really excited about that. But now that we've sort of established that, sure, these movies can, you know, play nice together and they can all sort of work together and write over each other's history a little bit here and there. But once we've established that, looking back on it now, like the first hour and a half of this movie is just it's like I want the Cliff's Notes version of that, because I get that we had to bring all of these guys together and they're scattered all over the place and they need to meet each other and have their awkward introductions and stuff. But it's like, holy crap, there is a lot of that stuff here.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that slow, because I think they injected enough comedy. The parts that I think feel slow, like I said, were the fight in the forest, and the some of the there's a which I you know it's just like an action figure fight. It's just like smashing two things together, and the there's some setup between when they have that. When they have Loki on board the helicarrier, and when the helicarrier is attacked, there's a lot of putzing around in there, which I don't know if you can trim it, because some of it was about the plot points, but it was still, it felt long. We didn't have an action.
The sitting around the table stuff in the helicarrier, talking about tracking gamma signatures and, oh no, there's blood in the cards now, all that kind of stuff, like from there to there.
Oh no! That's after. I'm talking about the before part where Bruce and Tony are chit chatting about how they're gonna track it, and then they like get into a conversation about how he can't control his anger, and then we have Thor and Phil Coulson talking, and you know he's explaining what some crazy beast is, and we've got Thor and ScarJo talking, and none of it really plays into the larger arc of what's happening, really. It gives us more flavor of these characters, but I wish it maybe had been done differently, because it didn't feel like it was moving along at a brisk pace through that. The only part that I really did like that set some tension in that scene is when Thor and Coulson are talking, Fury interrupts. And he says, you know, why do I get the feeling he, Loki, is the only one on this boat that wants to be here? There's a nice lingering, like, ominous note to that. That, I think, was pretty decent. It just is a long time that nothing's really happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I like that part, because it's kind of turning it from where you thought it was going to go. Although, if you're kind of in the midst of this sort of ambling about everyone, talking to everyone, you're not really sure where it's going or if it's going anywhere at all. And then you kind of get that sense from that little line from Fury kind of says, oh, the reason it feels like we're just sitting here is because something is happening in the background and we're not entirely sure what, and that should worry us all. And then that kind of kicks us into gear for the next bit of it. But there are a couple of those moments that are good, but they are kind of in the midst of a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, like, thank God we get that reaction shot from Pepper Potts on her private jet.
Yeah, what the hell? So I get why Tony would want to call her if he's about to fly through a portal to another dimension and he might not come back. why on earth would she not have her phone on her? Why would she not be trying to call him first time she realized that he was in a city and all of this bad stuff was happening?
I have no idea. I don't know why he wouldn't have updated her at all since the beginning of the film. I also, you know, I can understand why War Machine isn't in this movie, because it's not a movie about Iron Man and War Machine being in the Avengers, although War Machine has been in the Avengers in the comics before. It's weird that they don't even like mention his name as like, oh, well, you know, he's off doing something, so he can't be here, or his suit is broken or something.
You mean
like
the way they mention Jane Foster, yeah, has been taken
we sent her to an educational thing off in some place on a fancy jet. She's fine. Jane Foster's
because
fine.
Because even though we haven't talked to you in years, we knew you would be concerned about where your girlfriend was hanging out, so we decided to protect her. Although we apparently couldn't protect the other guy who got kidnapped by Loki.
Well, yeah. I mean, what I really want to know is Kat Dennings safe? That's what I want to know.
I like her too, yes. Yeah. So, although she's probably able to defend herself. She's
the best part of every Thor movie, and there have been two Thor movies. So, just so you know. She is out acting everybody in those films. So that, there's that.
It's a shame she can't catch a break working in that diner in New York.
Oh God, that show! Stupid horse. But the
thankfully there are no horses, space or otherwise, in this particular movie.
Oh God, that would be another Whedon thing. It's just what we need, the brown coats or whatever from their. And their stupid verse showing up. Ugh.
Maybe hiding in the background, you see somebody running around with the space pistol.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least this isn't Serenity. That's a high point of this film that we could all agree to.
Boy, oh boy.
At least this is better than Serenity. And like I said, this is, I think, better than me. You know, it's enjoyable enough to watch that I don't think this is a bad movie. I think I've seen this more than every other Marvel movie out there.
I mean, yeah. Of all the times it's just on TV and you just flick it on and watch bits and pieces here and there. But like, because of that and the fact that you usually miss the beginnings of movies that are just, they're on TV. I totally forgot that this actually started out on Thanos' little floating block of rubble in space where they kind of hand over the scepter to Loki and all that stuff.
Yeah,
but like that whole bit still seems so crowbarred into this whole thing. The creepy, what is he called? The other guy, is that him?
Yeah, the other and the Chitauri. Which the first time I saw this movie, I'm not gonna lie, I forgot who the Chitauri were by the time they showed up at the end bottle. I was just like, they set them up when? I mean, on the subsequent viewings, I've come to realize that they've been established much earlier in the film. It's just that. They have, like, nothing to do with anything for the majority of this film. So I don't even know. I mean,
that little bit started to make sense in the beginning of the movie where they were going to just let Loki rule Earth. They were going to give him the planet as long as he provided the cube, which, cool. That's essentially that initial scene, right?
Yeah, I mean, but there are several allusions here to war here and later when he threatens Fury in their Stargate Area 51 base. And then he talks about wars coming like right before the gate opens. And I'm just like, is this really a war? Like, I don't understand the dynamics of the power play here, but it doesn't really seem like a war. It just seems like you have a couple incompetent people just like, slowly trying to kill a bunch of people, since no one seems interested in capturing anyone or controlling anyone or making these people work for you or taking away constitutional rights and making them manufacture clothing. Like, I have no idea what his end goal here is or why you would even refer to it as a war, because it's obvious that they would just like lay waste to the planet Earth if it wasn't for the Avengers. So it just seems peculiar.
Loki does seem particularly scattered throughout this entire movie, but, you know, he's got a weird power dynamic with Thanos' crew too, because there's that like argument they have when they're building the portal where he does his like virtual 3D FaceTime projection thing back to Thanos' little rubble area.
Mm-hmm. Where I think it's called an Oculus Rift, Dan.
Sure, an Oculus Rift back to Thanos' rubble. He says, you know, they're basically saying like, okay, they want the cube and they're going to give Loki Earth. But in order to do that, he's already got the cube, but he's not going to give it to them until he gets Earth. And in order to do that, he's going to use the cube to open a portal to bring their guys in and then destroy everything and then give them the cube. Like it's very much like a chicken and egg thing. It's like, okay, he's got the cube, which is what they want, but he won't give it to them until the army gets here. Even and the army can't just like take it from him because they can't get through the portal because who knows where the hell they are in space.
Oh, but no, like, but they also want him to open the portal.
Why?
I can't remember. When he's talking to the other, he says, you need to open the portal. And he's like, well, I don't have the ability to open it yet. Or whatever he says. I can't remember the argument. But it doesn't make a lot of sense about why they really need to open. Because even if you open the portal, you can't send the thing that makes the portal through the portal. So how do you get that through exactly? Wouldn't you need, like, I don't know, a spaceship or some other means of conveyance?
Well, you can conjure some dark energy, which is apparently how Thor got there, or is a line that Loki says. But then apparently he conjured enough dark energy to send both himself and that little, like, twisty cube holder thing that he uses to get home, which we never saw until the very end, but he had to have brought with him when he first showed up and just, like, stashed somewhere.
Well, he left it in a safety deposit box in his street cart.
hit it in a train station where it was in plain view.
Yeah, Bourne Identity.
Exactly.
Yes. Maybe it was a...
Everyone knows you leave passports and guns and glass cube transport thingy-mabobbers in train stations.
Yeah, well, it was in the Asgardian go bag. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. It's one of those movies, like as we scrutinize all of the problems that we have with it that we've seen from repeated viewings, that it's one of those things where it's just like there are just problems for days. Like you could just keep digging. There are just things that
it's one of those movies. It's
sense.
Fun to watch. Yeah. We see all of our characters. They don't like each other. They don't play well. Eventually, they join forces relatively quickly.
Oh god! And you then mean they don't they work the as a team. They don't work as a team, and then they learn how to work as a team. That happens.
Not even learn. Like Captain America and Iron Man are about to they're about to fight. You know, put on the suit. Let's fight. And then the ship blows up, and he's like, "Yeah, you should put on your suit so we can work together and fight now." Like, just an explosion is really all it took for that to get them from fighting each other to being on the same side.
Can we talk about that explosion again?
You mean the ball of fire that sort of manifests in the center of the room and in between all of them?
Okay, so this explosion happens. Outside, there's an explosion. The engine has been taken out by the dinky little arrow, which I guess had like a thermonuclear device in it or something, because I don't know how it contained enough explosive force in order for this to happen, but it did. It takes out the engine. Everybody in there is like, oh, crap. And then Captain America and Iron Man have their little exchange of like, oh yeah, we gotta go, you know, go put on your suit, like you're saying. They walk out that door, and then we cut to a bunch of other action happening. And Fury is in a hallway somewhere talking to Anita Hill. He's not up on the bridge yet, but he's barking off some orders. And then we cut to Scarlett Johansson and Bruce Banner. Mark Ruffalo, and ScarJo is pinned underneath something, which must have happened in the explosion, but if they were just in the room with her, would they not have seen this happen? Because she wasn't outside of the room.
No, she flew out a window. They both flew out a window.
They did? Okay. I didn't see that happen. I watched it again.
I think that that big window that you are very annoyed that we're constantly looking out of, I think her and Banner flew out that window and landed in the bay area, and that's how that happened.
But there was no bay down below them, though.
Cause, I would certainly hope so. It's not just the big open area that the jet flies into.
Yeah, no, that's the open area the jet flies into. Because the area that they're in is completely enclosed, top and sides and everything. It, like, she goes up those stairs and stuff. Like, there's no daylight.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, I don't know what it, I should probably rewind and rewatch that again. Because it had been several years since I'd seen it. Tonight, so maybe I missed a moment and I should have refreshed it before we got on the podcast, but it didn't seem like that was in the same space at all. And then they have their fight, and then ScarJo gets away, and then the Hulk is knocked out into where they fight in the flight deck area underneath the main top level area, and then they get knocked into the lab from there. And so then when they're in the lab, then the jet comes in, shoots at the window, at the Hulk, because the window, I think, was still intact because they broke it with the bullets from that. And then the Hulk goes out the window, lands on that jet, and then, you know, that whole thing happens. So I don't think they were knocked by the force of the blast there. I think they just cut to that, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
And do you think... Here's an odd question, I guess, but do you think these sorts of geographic inconsistencies came about because somebody said it doesn't matter because they end up in a bay and this is an action movie and it's cool and that's not what people are focusing on? Or do you think it's kind of a movie this big, it's almost impossible to keep that consistency in mind when you're shooting it, especially when a lot of these sets are developed in post? And you could just say, well, now that we see the edit put together, we need to move this to a different place so they're kind of more separated from the other folks. Well, we can do that because we haven't actually built the set. But then when we do that, it's going to make this disconnect. Like, where do you think those things stem from?
Oh. I think a continuity break like that in these battles, it seems most likely that it came from editing choices that they made in order to economize or alter scenes that may have bridged that gap. I think they might have shot something intervening or whatever, but maybe they decided to omit it and get right to the cut to the chase.
Either that or just cut out like $200,000 worth of effects work.
Well, sometimes they're not doing it to get rid of the effects work, because I think it can just be because maybe a scene didn't work or it felt like there was too much of a lag or something, and so they'll just like move it along. But you know, I mean, these big blockbusters, they make almost all of the movie in editing, not in writing. Like the dialogue they write and they say that the order that things are said is completely dependent on whatever order they put the cuts together, so you know, things can change. I can't say for certain how this was arranged, but something like this being that different, I don't think it was because they didn't shoot coverage for it or something, or they lost, you know, the drive that had it on it. I think it was
no, but you don't think somebody in production said, "Screw it, we don't need to explain how we get from A to B because people aren't going to be paying attention to that. They're going to be watching the battle between character
I'm
X
sure,
and character Y."
I'm sure they said it as justification behind whatever they cut out, but you know, it'd be like, oh, nobody's gonna care. You know, because people generally don't. I mean, it's, you know, it didn't seem to affect the movie at all. It didn't. Box office is okay. They're making a sequel, so obviously not enough people wrote in to complain. I think it's fine.
Well, I don't think these are the kinds of things that people would write in to complain about. It's just, it leaves that sort of lingering confusion in the back of your mind while you're watching the movie. And generally, you can just move past it and enjoy the movie for what it is. But it does stay there, and it doesn't taint is the wrong word. It doesn't taint the movie for you, but it does sort of, it gives you this sort of overall feeling of confusion that may not necessarily have been intended. But the building the story out of editing is an interesting thing to say, because even watching like some of the end battle stuff, like the cars exploding and like in the very beginning when the normal people are running for cover, I can watch those individual shots and go like, oh, there's no way that was shot at the same time as these other things. And they're just sort of patched together because we've got cars exploding and chaos. But yeah, that's building it out of an edit.
Well, also they'll just be like, well, the tone of this is weird, and so they'll like rearrange some shots and they'll split some plates together and flop a plate and whatever. You know, this stuff happens. I can't say for certain what all has happened and transpired in editing, but something like this is heavily edited. So I wouldn't be surprised if several things are not as they appear on the original draft. Especially since nobody uses storyboards or anything anymore. The only really objectionable editing mistake that knocked me out of a film before was in the third X-Men movie, where Magneto rips up the Golden Gate Bridge in daylight and then drops it down in Alcatraz and it's nighttime. And it was just like this. Like, you knew when you shot this what time of day it was, and you knew when you shot this other thing what time of day it was. Like, what's the matter? Oh yeah, Brett Ratner directed this. There you go.
Should we use that as a segue to talk about some of the peculiar lighting in the battle scene?
Which battle scene? The end.
The end battle at this movie. Yeah, there are a lot of those individual vignettes where we go, let's go see what Hawkeye's doing over here, and he's fighting off a couple guys, and it's like, okay, he does a thing jumping off this building or whatever, and his lighting doesn't really match anything that else is around him. Or we've got Thor riding on top of the worm whale thing, and he doesn't look remotely like he's outside based on the shadows all over his cape and what have you.
Yeah, well, yes. There's one particularly difficult to swallow shot, and that is there's a one shot that they do, which isn't it's not really a one shot. It is stitched together from many different cuts, many different takes of things happening, to create in this thing called visual effects the illusion of a single shot, where we're panning from one character fighting something to another character fighting something to another character fighting something to another character fighting something, ultimately culminating in the whale thing, sky whale, crashing through the Grand Central Terminal. That's the cut we get at the end of it. So that one always sticks out to me because it feels so artificially constructed that we...
It's impressive, though.
It's impressive. It's just I'm saying that in a conceptual sense, it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
I know where it's all put together, so it doesn't feel there's not as much visual trickery at play for me in that one.
Specifically the one I'm talking about, where Thor looks like he was shot in a closet with a green curtain and just put into there.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. Who knows how they shot the original footage, so I'm not really like blaming. I think it was ILM that did everything in the end battle. I'm not nitpicking that. I'm just saying that it just conceptually, I don't know why you would try to like put this big long shot together out of all of these different takes in all of these different environments with all of these characters who are not really even like. Two of the characters are completely CG, Iron Man and the Hulk. So you're trying to sell those interacting with the CG environment, which some of it is constructed from the high resolution photography the HDR photography sampling spheres and crap that they took all over that area of New York. And then you've got, your plate photography that's just like stuck on cards inside of there. So like you're saying, it doesn't feel like it's the same thing.
Yeah, and just to be clear, my quibbles are not with the visual effects, because the one shot looks great, and the lighting on the city, and whether it's like some practical stuff from the photography or the CG characters, all of that stuff looks great. The stuff that doesn't look right is the stuff that was actually shot with a camera. And maybe it's because how would you even begin to visualize how far you've rotated in the world with this virtual camera that's going to end up lining up with this actual camera. But there are just a couple instances where in that sequence, the lighting looked like it was on a stage versus outside. And of course it was all in a stage, like that entire main street with the bus blown up and the stuff where they're jumping around and what have you. All of that stuff is indoors, and it's a very large green screen set, but it's still indoors.
But I thought those were more convincing.
For sure.
There are some things with what stands out to me are the reflections on the glass throughout this film. There's a ton of glass in this film. Glass.
You mentioned that. I tried to keep an eye on it, but I want to hear what you were talking about specifically. Like, give me shots that were sticking out to you.
Okay, well, there's like a waitress or something inside one of the cafes right when the attack starts, and she's looking outside, and we're seeing the explosion that's composited onto the glass for the cafe there. We're seeing, like, on the helicarrier, there's like reflections of clouds or something, which are played very heavily on the very, very clear glass of the helicarrier windows. All the Minority Report displays, they have some interesting choices. It wasn't the glass in the Stark Tower. Anyway, they're it's just like one of those things where I was watching it and I just standing out to me, like, how much effort went into putting stuff inside of the reflections of on the glass in all of these shots, because they had shot so many shots with glass.
One of the ones that I don't know if it was practical, but I think they would have at least tried to do it practical, is when Loki is talking to Black Widow through the cylinder thing, and it's got that sort of curved glass distortion of his face, like as he's ranting and walking towards her. So she's the main shot, but the reflection is of Loki and being all distorted and angry and what have you.
I don't know if that was practical. I think it might have been.
Yeah, I think it was, but it was yet another reflection.
Well, I was specifically talking about all the things they were inserting into these things.
Generally, the thing that sticks out to you is how clearly and brightly we can see these reflections?
Oh, I'm not saying that they're not appropriately done or that they're too clear or something, but just that it sticks out to me that we see so much in them, in the sense that there's so much glass that needs reflections in them, that maybe they shouldn't have had so much glass. But I don't know. I don't know if that's really a legitimate criticism. Just so much. Okay. So much glass.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just trying to get to the bottom of your hatred of glass.
Yes, well...
Why do you hate glass?
Because Google, Dan.
That's a different... is that actually made out of glass, or is that plastic?
I have no idea.
I thought you had one.
No. Why would I have one?
Well, I mean, you don't like the watch, but I figure you might like the ocular version.
Oh, so that's how it is. Because I don't like the Apple Watch, I'm a Google fanboy.
There's only two teams, right? You got to pick one or the other. You can't in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about good versus evil. Dark versus the light.
Depending on your perspective, one might just be misguided instead of actually bad.
No, but when they work together as a team, then they can defeat the Chitauri, and then world peace. The end.
So you can look into your Google Glass and see what your watch display is without actually having to look down at your watch.
Yes, something Hail Hydra.
That's good synergy. Oh yeah, of course Hydra makes its way back into this movie with the what was it, Plan B, Plan Two? What was
Phase
it?
Two.
What do they call it? Phase Two.
Yes, because you know, whenever they just talk about something at the beginning of the movie, referring to it only as Phase Two, that it's going to be totally innocuous and not a big deal at all.
And Fury says that this was like a contingency plan that he had going in the background, but based on the fact that it's called Phase 2, wouldn't that mean it's kind of in the same lineage as this other Phase 1 plan?
Yes.
I don't know that I believe his excuse.
No, it really should have been called Plan B. I mean...
I think that has some negative connotations.
Well, no. Well, you know, it's your backup plan. That's what they always call Plan B. But the... so, yeah. Phase 2, ominous. And then, you know, let's hack the mainframes. And they do. And let's break into the storage locker that's not locked or monitored with security. It just has, like, a you know, push-it-open kind of a lock. And find the crates full of hay and hydro weapons.
Well, they're old-fashioned weapons, so you got to use old-fashioned padding in those very nice silver boxes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was... And... It's one of those things where, you know, they're setting up the fact that they, you know, were going to do this as their backup plan. If they couldn't get the Avengers together, they needed a way to defend themselves. So they were going to arm themselves with weapons that had Tesseract energy in them. But this sort of goes to the implausibility of S.H.I.E.L.D. as any sort of thing at all, really. Because they have a giant floating carrier with holographic invisibility and nuclear weapons that just flies around wherever and works with a cabal of secretive world government people.
Well, what they should do is instead of making their own hydro weapons, they should just go around New York and pick up the blaster scepter things that were dropped by all of the now dead bad guys and use those.
No, they don't have power anymore, Dan, because the mothership was destroyed.
So the scepters lost power too?
Well, didn't you see all the purple lights turn off? That means that they don't have power.
I didn't know that the weapons had sort of a remote disable like an iPhone too.
I'm just assuming. I don't know. Maybe they address this on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television series, which I watched two episodes of and could not choke down.
So do you think in this movie it was edited with some ambiguity and Fury lied because Coulson wasn't actually dead? Or do you think he died and they're just kind of like rewriting that? I haven't seen Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to know if they actually tried to explain away why he's not dead.
I only saw the first two episodes, so I know that they hint that they might acknowledge it later, but I didn't see any hint of it being acknowledged in any timely fashion, so I can't tell you. And I don't feel like looking it up on Wikipedia to spoil it for myself. But
well, no, I just I assumed that he like died in this movie, but they were right there. The medical team was right there, so they were able to revive him. But of course, on the radio, Fury just said, "Yeah, they're calling it he's dead," because he wanted to motivate everybody. And then he rubbed blood all over his limited edition cards, which is a really jerk thing to do.
Well, in Marvel and in S.H.I.E.L.D., there are these things called life model decoys, and Tony Stark even makes a joke about the fact that he had reached a life model decoy of Tony Stark when Coulson calls. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe he's one of those. But it doesn't matter. Coulson's sacrifice is, I don't know, it was kind of sad, but pointless.
Well, for the audience, it was sad. I remember being in the theater the first time I saw it, and I was like, oh, man, that's a bummer. We like him.
Yeah, it was a real bummer. But, you know, the fact that he came back makes it kind of pointless.
Well, we didn't know he was coming back then.
Oh, no, we didn't. We got a wonderful television show that hardly anyone watches out of it. But
do you remember any of your other first reactions in the theater? Because I remember a few that have sort of mellowed over time, like the Hulk grabbing Loki and doing the ragdoll smash on the floor. I remember the audience loved that so much. They were laughing and cheering that you couldn't even hear Hulk deliver his puny god line afterward because everyone was laughing too loudly.
I heard it, but everyone was laughing, yes, and I was laughing too. Because it's funny.
Yeah, I had no idea what he said there.
I'm sorry.
I guess the crowds are a little more raucous in San Jose.
Oh, I'm sorry. You poor thing. You were denied your puny god line. No, I mean, I like I said, when I initially watched this, I had a far more favorable view of it, because you're just sort of along for the ride. And I said something similar about, you know, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies. You're just sort of along for the ride when you see them, but they don't hold up when you start dissecting why things are happening. That it becomes very focused on the animated expression of these characters interacting in the moment, and that the things they say and do don't often add up to well, anything that makes sense. So there's that. So I you know, like I said, I really enjoyed it and even went back to go see it, like, I think it was less than a week later with Jason. And then that was the one where I was just like, oh, there are a couple of things that aren't as much fun as I remember them being.
Well, it was, I agree, super fun to see in the theater, but over time it loses a little bit of charm. And it does, again, feel a lot older to me than it actually is, especially just because the Marvel Universe has grown so much in the intervening time. But still, as you said, not what you would call a bad movie, but there's still a lot of things about it that are just kind of odd. But I don't know, you looking forward to seeing Ages of Mangos this Friday or this weekend or whenever you're going to go see it?
Yeah, I don't know when I'm going to arrange to see it exactly. Jason has told me he has zero interest in seeing the sequel since he didn't like the first one at all. So I have to budget some time in for that. But I don't know. I've seen some reporting out of it that I haven't read it, but just I've seen the overall headlines that have projected like huge amounts of money. And I've also projected that maybe I won't like it. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, there's no way it's not going to make a ton of money. That's just a foregone conclusion.
Yeah. I mean, a friend of the show, Mike Hurley, when pressed for a response, said that he liked it because it's already out in England. Because remember, they gave them those 31 million pounds in tax rebates. So they
is that why they get it first there?
I guess so. Well, it's probably because of the Memorial Day holiday. They want to capitalize on that weekend, I assume.
Movies are weird.
Yeah. Wait. Is it Memorial Day this weekend? No, it's not. What am I talking about? Just a normal weekend, right?
Yeah, there's nothing this weekend. I'm looking at my Fantastical.
Oh, okay. Then it's just about the money.
Actually, let's see. The first one was released on May 4th, so that's probably as close as they could get to May 4th.
Okay. May the 4th be with you. I don't know.
Oh, God. Are you one of those people that says that to other people?
No, I don't. I'll try to make an effort to do that to you this May 4th. But a lot of people were bummed that Star Wars was not coming out May 4th because they feel like that is an appropriate day for that at all times, no matter what.
By a lot of people, do you mean people who dress up like Star Wars characters?
I'm assuming so. I make a lot of assumptions.
I don't think regular people were concerned about that.
Yeah, I think they call them Star Warsies, not Star Warsers. I don't know.
I always get that wrong.
Yeah. So I think we're done here.
Yeah. Any last thoughts on avenging the planet?
No, just keep blowing up the Earth.
You like that they slipped the line in the movie where they said the name of the movie in there?
I always love that, Dan. It's my favorite thing in the world.
Well, if we can't protect our podcast, you can be sure we'll try and avenge it, but then give up very shortly because AirPlay isn't working.
No, but then we'll work as a team. All your Apple devices will work as a team, and they'll defeat the eel whale and save the day, and your rental will go through.
The truth is in the cloud, and by in the cloud, we mean the helicarrier is floating up there in the cloud, and that's where they keep the truth.
Is Tim Cook Nick Fury?
That would be pretty rad. See him rocking an eye patch and that like leather trench coat thing.
Hi, this is Tim. That'd be nice. He's really excited about customer sat.
Yes, they're there to defend the world against poor customer sat.
By that, he means customer satellites that constantly monitor everything you're doing and you're going to find a photo of Loki.
Sure, the customer sats are going to link up and make all of the helicarriers work together to assassinate bad people.
Spoiler alert, Dan.
I didn't spoil anything because we're not saying what that's from. We should stop here before we make this podcast officially as long as the movie.
Yeah, it's another short one, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And how? It was a style at the time.
It's very warm in here.
Will Wheaton.